Okay, so this is me, Max Schlitzinger. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation, the committee, the two that are here. This is going to be my first talk in my own country. I've been over on the other side of the puddle for a while. It's nice to be back. Enjoy the weather as well. So I'm going to talk about work I've been doing. The title is Global Parameters of Type 1A Supernova. And right now I'm currently stationed in Denmark, the Niels Bohr Institute. Okay, so basically I'm just going to show results in four publications here that have been out in the last 18 months. And then since I know the people at the NPA have seen this mostly, at the very end I've added some new stuff that they haven't seen, late time and emission of some type 1A supernova. So basically the issues that these try to address are, you know, what do we know from observations? You know, the energy source, energetics, what powers the light curves? The nickel mass. I'm going to, for Lars, have a talk about one paper where we place limits on the ejected mass. And then these three or more were addressed in Paolo's talk, was it Wednesday? But we might touch on them a little bit. And so basically, quickly throw this one up. The usual procedure is take an explosion model, like Wolfgang does, and then we get an output from that. It goes input in the, into codes by like this guy. And then we kind of compare that to observations. And we always assume a progenitor. So I just kind of put this all up a little bit more clear in a diagram like this. So here we go. We have the explosion model. We get the density profile, distribution of synthesized elements, explosion energy. These are all inputs for the radiation transfer codes. Also, Daniel talked quite a bit yesterday about that. Calculate spectra and light curves, and then now we can compare it to the observations. You know, are there differences? Well, there has been a lot of differences in the past. So these differences kind of feed back into the explosion model. And the explosion model is always assuming, a progenitor. And we know what that assumption is, a Chandrasekhar-sized white dwarf. And so the work I've done is try to take these comparisons and see, are we actually doing these things right? Do the spectra computed and light curves match with their observations, and how can we improve the exposure models? And do the exposure models actually produce parameters that, that compare to observations? Okay, so first, there's four parts of the talk. They're each a few slides. First one is about Arnett's rule. I'm going to try to convince you that Arnett's rule is actually, it works pretty good. I didn't know that it did. Especially the theorists have a lot of doubts about Arnett's rule. They think it's quite simple, but it turns out it actually works quite well. So Arnett's rule.
Is it a rule or a law?
From what I heard, Dave Arnett prefers a rule. I haven't talked about it, but Bruno said that. It's a rule, not a law. Why did I put a law? I don't know. It is a rule.
It was a law, but now it became a rule.
Yeah.
Exceptions.
Yeah, you're right. It is a rule. It's a rule. Okay, so Arnett's rule basically says a peak at time of peak brightness, luminosity is equal to the energy deposition rate in the ejecta. Okay, to use Arnett's rule, it requires a measure of the bolometric luminosity at peak. So how do we do that? We take multi-filter observations and place it, and combine those, make a bolometric light curve, and then we need a measure of the reddening and the distance to put on absolute flux scale. Basically, the method I used was came out by Leibengut and Tannery, and then Gertrude Contardo, one of Wolfgang's older students, used it, and I've kind of continued up, followed up on her work. And so this is from her thesis. This is just 92 BC. It's been scaled up to a certain mass. And so what are all these lines? So here's the bolometric light curve. And while we use a multi-filter, it turns out that 85% of the flux, more or less, of maximum light does come out in the optical from 3,000, 10,000 angstroms. So we really do get a good measure of the true bolometric luminosity. So here's the bolometric light curve. We have, here's decay times of cobalt, nickel, and then these lines, this line here is for complete trapping of gamma rays and complete escape of gamma rays. And so basically we use Arnett's rule to calculate the nickel mass. Paolo showed the equation, so I won't. Basically 2 times 10 to the 43 ergs per second per solar mass of nickel 56. Before I show you the results of that, Arnett's rule here is this is a model from the MPA group. So this is the bolometric light curve, and it seems that Arnett's rule is quite consistent, at least for these 3D deflagration models. So here is just deposition of gamma rays. Okay, and so what do we get if we apply Arnett's rule? Well, first, here's a sample of bolometric light curves. I have lots of them. No, just the color coding is just the absolute flux scale has been set by distances, excepheds, and surface brightness fluctuations. The rest are redshifts. And before I show you Arnett's rule, what you can see is here a large range in luminosity. You can see there's these secondary these inflection points that correspond to secondary maximums. These seem not to be really dependent on the peak energy. Although I think Daniel Kaysen's had some interesting work in the last paper, and I'd like to talk to him about that. The big uncertainty here is the errors in the distance, obviously, and then the reddening. And then if you look at the really late times, these differences seem to even to increase even more. So then applying Arnett's rule.
What's that one that's declining?
This one right here?
Is that 86G?
No, that's 2002 CX. 86G, I don't have enough data. I need to get at least good light curves, BVRI, with early sampling to get the fit proper. No infrared. There is no infrared, really. If you publish some data, I'll be happy to use it. And there will be one day soon, with maybe what you're doing with the CSP. There will be some.
We're going to hear about infrared observations on
Wednesday. Yeah.
So if I would do some delta M15 on your bolometric light curves, then we know delta M15
relation. There is a relation. I don't have that in this talk. Let's see. I made a plot in this last paper, Paolo, where I did delta M15 UVOR versus delta M15B, and there is a correlation. There's some scatter at the maybe the bright ones, but there's a correlation. I'll show that to you later. It's not in the talk. You see that? So then I just apply Arnett's rule directly and get a range of nickel masses. So basically, you see that there's a range and factor of 10 here. And so here we have these subluminous guys. Seems like the main population is a little bit over half a solar mass. And right here, no more than a solar mass of nickel 56. And remember that, because we're going to use that in the next segment of the talk to place lower limits on the Hubble constant. Okay, so now people will say Arnett's rule, it's just approximations and it's not really that valid. So now I'm going to try to convince you it actually works. So first we check it with a different method. So Paolo showed all this. This is from one of his ancient papers where these are nebular spectra, right? And he uses his one of his codes to fit these iron 2 and iron 3 lines. So basically, he doesn't fit individual lines, but the sum of these lines, because they're just a blend of many lines. And he found this relationship here where brighter events have larger, so brighter events are down here, slower decline rates have larger expansion velocities, or widths, I should say, not expansion velocities.
Those are measurements of iron.
That's right. This is nebular spectra.
Right.
Wolfgang. Yes.
So really, the slide should say non-nickel masses, right? Iron group masses?
Nickel mass, yes, because when he does this, he takes a W7 profile and...
It's as input a density profile.
That's right.
And it's W7.
Yeah, and he just... he can tell us what he does. Well, that's...
No, because I feel the emission and every particular velocity. That's transparent. And so you actually get the mass out. Well, we have both ions in that spectrum.
I guess I have a simple question. Is this an iron line or a nickel line?
Iron. This is at late time, there's no nickel left. Okay, these are iron 2 and iron 3 lines.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, question answered. Okay, so he does this fit. Go ahead.
But he measures the nickel.
Sorry?
He measures the nickel because he needs the
right.
Of something to ionize your iron.
We show.
So measure where the iron is.
Show that the ratio of nickel to cobalt to iron changes with time.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what you're asking.
Does
this stuff have its origin in the radioactive?
Yeah, that's my question. At late times, how do you
answer
yourself
that
its origin is radioactive?
Because
the
ratio of
cobalt
to iron changes.
Because if you look earlier on, there's a line that goes away, and that is a cobalt line. It goes away with time. This is what
But if there was non-radioactive iron in the supernova, you would see it here because it's being excited by the energy that's coming. So it's not just the nickel, it's the
There's a little bit left over iron. Okay. And so basically we can compare the the nickel estimates, right? So I mean, here we have delta and 15 platted versus the nickel, what I get from the UVOR light curves. I should note that when I do use Arnott's rule, I didn't take that nickel mass and I increase it by 10% to account for flux that is in infrared. Okay, and so we find some sort of correlation here. This is for Paolo stuff. There is some sort of correlation here. I mean, it seems to be quite linear. You know, the brighter events have slower decline rates. And likewise, it seems to be a little bit better with the UVOR. Now, these lines aren't best fit lines. That's a Phillips relationship from 1999. And then this dotted line here is just if I increase the bolometric correction. So it seems to be in concordance with other work that's been published, that luminosity is yep. Spend it on nickel mass.
This is more used to what I saw on your previous slide. There was really no clear correlation. If you take these 2 points out,
Well, the point is that the nickel masses do seem to be, compared to each other. Okay, so I mean, here we have the nebular nickel mass versus the UVOR nickel mass, and these offsets are errors of 10 and 20%. And within 10%, I mean, of these 17 events, plus or minus 10%, the majority of them agree within 10%.
But again, just naive.
Yeah. Let me go back.
I take the left two and the left corner, these 2 points.
I get rid of the subluminous guys.
Yeah, so I take them out, and then the rest, okay, it's a scatter diagram.
I don't really agree, because if you didn't look, of all these points, the majority of them agree within 10%.
There's still a correlation.
The best thing is to make
the Well, we're not. I mean, this is this.
This is my guess.
It's a comparison. Now we're.
Put arrow bars on your points.
Well, I can do that, and I in the paper I argue why I don't. We're just trying to make a direct comparison. And what's nice about this comparison is basically mostly circumvents the errors and the distance and the reddening. But, and then, I mean, sure, I can put on air bars on here. I mean, we had them on the last plot. We had air bars. Okay, well, then let me go another way and try to convince you that Arnott's rule works, okay? Let's check with your models, Wolfgang. let's go to the source of the lion's den here, okay? Basically, this is another way to make a check of Arnott's rule. Okay, I don't like the last way. Paolo, sorry, your models aren't working quite well. So what we do here in this method, this is the Blinnikoff paper. Okay, you have another point?
Well, it's just the models you compare with a particular kind of models.
Yeah.
And these models are centrally ignited, so the nickel distribution in that star is almost spherical. And therefore, I think one of the basic assumptions of Arnott's rule is justified and valid for this type of model.
Yeah, for us, spherical symmetry.
So you're going to say test consistency of assumptions that had entered Arnott's rule, derivation of Arnott's rule, with models that more or less are in agreement with those assumptions. And though I'm not so much surprised, and then the only thing that might be tested this way is, say, the radial distribution of nickel and the mixing.
Yeah.
And so it's, again, one of the assumptions of Arnott's rule is that most of the nickel is more centrally
absolutely
contemplated, and this is true for the deflectation model as well.
I would like to do this with other models as well, if we get some other light curves.
Any model that has a nickel more centrally concentrated in that star, and has a nickel in a more spherical distribution, okay, Arnott's rule should hold.
So basically, he just gave you the answer, what I'm going to show you. It holds. But I would like to have bolometric light curves from, say, delayed detonation models and do this same game. Let me explain the game, all right? So we're going to take the models of Roepke, and then we put that as input to Sergei's SED code, and he makes a bolometric light curve. And then I'm going to take, from that bolometric light curve, you can also make a multi-filtered light curve, UBVRI, and then I'm going to take those UBVRI light curves, apply my method, recalculate the nickel mass, and compare it to the input. So what I get, equals input. All right. So before I do that,
we'll go to the next one.
That's right. Bob right there. Looks like Wolfgang right now. I mean, these are just B and V light curves. This is versus explosion time versus maximum light. This is Mlynikov's paper, and these are just four of Wolfgang's models, right? And you know, this is the bright one. This gives you about 0.4 solar mass nickel 56 and some less bright ones. Okay, so, and then before I do the test, now here's just a comparison of the models, the real data. So we have a 92A bright one, well, kind of bright, and a really subluminous one. And what the solid line is, it's just taking the integration of light from 3,000, 10,000 angstroms, and then of Wolfgang's model, right? What's coming out when Sergei takes Wolfgang's model's input and calculates the light curve. And then here is just the summation of the total flux from the UV all the way out to infrared. So, I mean, the models, the best, these are the best published ones right now?
No.
No? But best published ones right now. I mean, they can more or less fit the moderate luminous, but not the bright ones.
I will show the light curve for Ushnov in one of my talks. It agrees better.
You get more nickel.
We get more nickel actually if the decay of the light curve is more close to the observation.
Okay, so you don't have the save. Okay, you've worked that out, the problem. No, these are just observational data, UVor light curves.
That is some kind of representation of what the data might be like.
No, it's a summation of the UBVRI filters.
You have a data point in every
point? Yeah, so I fit a function if you want to know the method. Yeah. So that function has no physics, it's just purely descriptive, you know? All right. Oh, okay, all right, fine. Yeah. I prefer for lines, but Sergei wanted the points, so I like the lines better.
It's okay.
Yeah, okay.
It's okay.
But we're getting data like this now, aren't we?
There's the moon.
The moon. Okay, and now here's the check, okay? And so here is the black dots is just a summation of 3,000, 10,000 angstroms light from the radiative transfer code with input from Wolfgang's model. The red line is when I take those computed UBVRI light curves and I put them all together and make my own UVor light curve. And so these quite agree, quite well. And then this is the Bolan-McGregor light curve including all the flux, okay? And so we find these agree. Obviously there's an offset, and initially I've been using a 10% correction once I get the luminosity to include the flux that's outside the optical window. It turns out that the offset is more like 15%, so I'm missing out by 5%. And how I know that is from here, with plus 10%, I get a nickel mass, and I go back and I compare that nickel mass I calculate to the nickel mass that comes from the models. And I did that for the four models I showed in a couple of slides before. And I recover the nickel mass to within 0.05 of a solar mass. So, I mean, this is the check. Okay, now let's try it with a set of models that don't have the nickel inside. Let's do it. Well, that'll be interesting. Okay, so, well, are people convinced that it kind of gives you a good measure of nickel? And that's an extra 20% that might account for this factor of 10 in nickel mass. So what explains that? I would just put that up at the conclusions and we can discuss that. That'd be very interesting. Okay, so that's the first segment. 15 minutes down. Let me move on to some work that Bruno really seems to like, and so I'll just explain that really quick. And this is the lower limits on the Hubble constant by combining models with these UVor light curves. So I don't know about all of Germany, but at least at the MPA, once you have your defense, they make you a hat. And they're usually quite complex with lots of little trinkets and pictures, but somehow I got this is a Moss Kruger from the Hofbrauer House, and they substituted HB for H-naught.
Well, you should show it.
It's the first time I've showed it. It's a great place to study. Yeah. Do you know any people that want to do a PhD? I recommend Munich. And you'll learn to like beer and get a belly like me. So, I mean, this is very simple and straightforward, so I'll throw up the equations how we get this. We're going to use Hubble's law, we're going to use luminosity distance, and then energy deposition from the nickel cobalt decay, okay? So let me put all these equations together. This is, it's really straightforward. I think this is why Bruno likes to show this all the time. So we have the Hubble law, right? We all know that one. I mean, it's very simple equations here. Then we throw in luminosity distance, we solve, and we'll plug in for D, luminosity distance. Okay, now we're going to use Arnett's rule, which I think kind of works for at least what we've done so far, it seems to be. Arnett's rule, okay? And then we just throw in, you know, the nickel cobalt decay, okay? And a rise time. So this energy deposition is dependent on these things, okay? And so alpha is this conversion of nickel energy into radiation. So Arnett's rule says the ratio alpha luminosity energy deposition is 1. Okay, maybe it's not 1. Maybe there's a little bit of radiation in the ejector that's trapped, and as the light curve overshoots the radioactive decay deposition function, there'll be excess of flux. Okay, but and then here is energy deposition. So basically, to get the Hubble constant, all we need is measure the bolometric flux and a redshift. Right, okay? With Z, okay? Over here. Right here. Z and the flux. And we're going to use the models as a guide for the nickel mass. That's why we say lower limits for models. Okay, what are the assumptions in all this? Is the rise time. I assume a rise time of 19 days. It's how that varies from event to event, I'm not sure if it's quite clear. I haven't really read the Supermacho paper, if you really comment on it, or even you're on it.
No.
Okay, so the rise time, maybe 10% uncertainty. Okay, again, Arnett's rule may not be exactly 1, okay, so I account for that too in a plot I'll show you. And then this is the main assumption, nickel mass from the models uniquely defines the bolometric peak luminosity. So I'll explain that a little bit more in the next slides. Okay, so here's a plot of that equation I showed you 2 slides ago. I mean, here's H naught, the Hubble constant, versus the amount of nickel 56. And then from the equation you saw, we see basically what we have here, have, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 supernova. And I've plotted for each supernova the nickel mass versus H naught. So this is maybe 12 events, and I've just plotted it as a function of nickel mass. And what you see is this 1 over square root of m dependence that I derived in the equation. Okay, what these lines are, this is the nickel mass from the best MPA model that's published. This is W7, okay? And remember earlier when I showed you distribution of nickel, I calculated the upper limit was 1, and, okay? And then this is the lower limit. What I want to say here is there's a problem with this, though. Since supernova have individual nickel masses, and we really don't know which one it is. We don't know what nickel mass really is applied to each one of these events. So the only thing we can do then that it seems to be valid is to go for a lower limit. And how we go for a lower limit is we're going to take the least luminous of these normal type 1A supernova and assign a nickel mass of 1 solar mass, because that is as bright as they seem to be. You know, the amount of nickel of 1 solar mass gives us the brightest event. So I'm going to take this guy, the lowest guy here, I'm going to ignore these guys, say they're not normal, they're not in the normal population. If you don't like that, well, I can say that they're 40% less luminous and therefore produce 40% less nickel, those subluminous guys. Okay, so here it is. This is, it turns out to be 99 AA, and there's H-naught versus solar mass of nickel 56. And then here is the models, NPA, W7, and then our upper limit. So upper limit on the nickel mass. So here's the equation. It's plotted here with 1 and 3 sigma error bars. Those are kind of not really statistical but sensible errors. And then this dashed line is if alpha is actually 1.2. So maybe the luminosity a little bit after at maximum light exceeds the energy deposition rate. So that would lower the Hubble constant. But you have to keep in mind that I'm not including the total flux. So if I included the emission and the infrared, it's not very much, but if I included it, that would move this up. So they almost cancel each other. And so, I mean, here we get 3 sigma away is 40, and 1 sigma is 50. We can of course turn this argument around. Say we know H naught to very good confidence, but we think it's 70. So if I'm going to say it's 70, I can just put a line right across here, and we get nickel masses between 0.4 and 0.6. The whole motivation of this, I forgot to say, was the Hubble constant is known to 70. I mean, there's some papers out that argue that the Einstein-De-Sitter model can fit the CMB power spectrum as good as the best lambda CDM models, but they really require a low H naught. That was really the motivation, is to give another method to calculate H naught. Mm-hmm. Questions? OK. Okay, that's just simple equations. I think he likes it just because of this. Just very simple equations, and there's not all this stuff going in with the HST method of determining HNOT. I mean, if you really look at all the details and all the sources of error that you can occur, you can really argue that 70 may not be really, I mean, the error bars there are quite high. That's why it's connecting, you know, models with cosmology. He likes it.
Or is there an assumption here, though, that
the mass of the Higgle is not going to change very much from, you know, type 1A supernovae that happened earlier in the universe to what happened today? These are all local. But actually, these ones here are all in the Hubble flow. All the ones, that was the criteria for all these guys I picked, they're all in the Hubble flow. And then you'll see that Daniel showed yesterday, you can do the same game and build a Hubble diagram and you can get the same numbers. If you take between 0.4 and 0.6 solar mass Nicol 6, you get between 70 and 80 of HNOT. And the lower limit again gives you nothing less than 50. Okay.
So then we kind of go back to your plot. So if we run the clock back 30 years and Sandy's in the roof, start right back to the
right? Arnett and Branch and Weaver wrote a paper of this exact type where they
absolutely
know
did.
How much nickel is made, we calculate the luminosity. And we find the Hubble
cone. The only difference here is we're using a measure of the bolometric flux. They use the V-band and do a bolometric correction. That was the only thing that's really different.
Oh, whatever was covered.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So that's the difference between those two papers. It was 50, maybe, more or less. Okay, so Einstein de Sitter models, people still, I like that. Okay, so, all right, now let's go on. This is for Lars. This is maybe, this what I'm going to show here, it gets a little iffy for people. We're just, you know, using what we can do here. And so basically, we try to use the UVOR light curves to place constraints on the ejected mass. Well, not many people have tried this. Paolo just explained to us on Wednesday that that's all Chandrasekhar mass. Okay, everyone believes it. Well, anyways, let's just go through this. Basically, Dave Jeffries has a preprint on AstroPH. He never went through the referee. He submitted it, but didn't do the referee process. And in this paper, he takes energy deposition functions and he fits them to models, okay, light curve models, not real data. And he gets this equation, basically, is this, okay, that the ejected mass is dependent on these parameters, where this is a mean opacity, ranges between 0.025 centimeters squared per gram, okay, to 0.033. Q is a factor that describes the distribution of nickel within the ejecta. If it's all concentrated in the core, it's going to be 1. If it's evenly distributed, it's going to be 1/3. And then V, this is, what is this? This is a modeled velocity of the density distribution. Right, Paolo? It's basically equal. It's equal to the square root of the energy divided by the mass.
Inverse whatever.
Yeah. Okay, and in this plot where we have just a bolometric light curve, and then I've just plotted for a set nickel mass this energy deposition function for different T knots, and basically, as you increase T knot, you get you get these lines up here. And basically, what that physically means is as you increase the mass, you increase the diffusion time. It takes longer for the radiation to escape. Okay, now, if I do the fits here, so here's just I have a sample of 15, 16, 17. I have the requirement, the constraints for the data here was that we're going to do the fits between 50 and 100 days. Between 50 and 100 days, we can essentially say that all the nickels more or less decay to cobalt. And when you only have one radioactive species, you can replace the opacity with a 1 over a T squared law. Okay, and this is all in the Jeffries paper, and it explains this equation. So this equation is only valid if you're fitting these energy deposition functions between 50 and 100 days past maximum. And we have just a sample for the bright 91T to the subluminous, a couple in the middle. And so I did this for a bunch of them and made this plot for Lars. I'm glad to hear you like it. This is the ejected mass versus the nickel mass. Yeah, I love it. I think that's right. And so here I've used fiducial values. I've used 3,000 for this velocity. If you go and search through the literature of 1D models, this velocity will range from about 2,800 to 3,300. That's deflagration models, including double detonation, delayed detonation. I use 3,000. Okay. Opacity, again, I use 0.025. Q, we used 1/3 because that's what W7 gives you. Seems to fit spectra quite well. And this is what we get. We get a distribution of ejected masses like this. So again, here we have solar masses ranging from about 0.1 to about, in this case, a 0.85, 0.9.
You've seen why you're getting
that. Hmm?
You're doing exactly what I've been doing in the use of intermediate masking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there is actually no discrepancy.
So if you add those masses, mm-hmm. or subtract them, whatever it is.
I've done that, and I say that's the measure of IMEs.
Right.
Assuming it's a Chandrasekhar mass. Yeah, that was my question for Paolo in the hallway, and he ran away and didn't give me an answer. What about these guys? Oh, these are 91BG, 98DE, or 99BY. Right. So my question was, do the intermediate mass elements that you see, I mean, the difference that Bob just said, do we see that in the spectra of carbon, oxygen, or?
Nickel mass we agree.
It's 0.1. Yeah.
So the numbers are same.
No, I'm talking about the ejected mass.
Well, I'm telling you, you're not including the intermediate mass.
Yeah.
Because they have no opacity.
So are they one solar mass? It is one solar mass.
Exactly the same.
Okay. That was my question for you.
It's exactly the same thing.
So last summer you didn't say that. Last summer you said, I don't see the mass, so you've learned something. I remember.
I came in thinking that VG was very subtractive.
Yeah.
I came out thinking it wasn't.
So if you do this exercise, basically, for those fiducial values, we have about a Chandrasekhar.
I'm sure if everybody's understanding, I think what the message is that what Max has done is the mass of material that has a high opacity. That's MEJ. And what you're saying is that since that's not 1.2 or 1.4, therefore there must be a mass.
Chandrasekhar from a Z of 10 would say that. What I'm saying is that you see the rest of the mass in intermediate mass.
Because in the spectra of the subluminous, you've got enough information.
Do you have enough spectra? It seemed in your game you were needing lots of spectra, but I mean, we don't have so many spectra for these guys to map out.
We have enough.
You have enough.
Maximum phase where the supernova is doing strong.
So you end up seeing intermediate mass elements under much, much lower velocities than the subluminous.
I have a plot showing that.
Right? Okay,
but no velocity of the supernova is the same as the high velocity.
So the physical picture actually is, one positive physical picture is that you have a deflagration. The deflagration may end having produced maybe a tenth or 2/10 or 3/10 of the solar mass. But then in some cases you may have some transition to detonation, which then would add nickel and burn up the intermediates. In some other cases you might not.
So these might just be a deflagration.
Intermediates, like we have this quite a bit of intermediates, leaving you the subluminous type 1A.
So then I'll tell you why the problem got. Which is that the rise times for the subluminous, then must be short. Everything you said is fine, but they only tested your model that remains.
Why should it be shorter?
Because you've got a less mean opacity, and therefore the time is being shorter.
In which case?
So the subluminous, everything you said is true. There's an explanation, which is that the rise, the time of peak is not going to be 19 days. It's going to be 14 days, or 13 days, or 12 days. Must be true.
No, 15.
Yeah, but that matters, because that is the actual only prediction to make that hasn't been shown. So I would claim if you actually believe that, you should really do the rise time, that it's a shorter rise time.
It's not an easy project for 71
No, it's trivial for you. You've got it. I'm saying.
I have it, and so the observers, it's not easy for them.
It's very rare.
It's
very rare.
It's kind of
very rare.
What about the structure of the ejecta in those models that do not undergo the transition to?
Well, it's just a possibility statement. Yeah, okay, let's say. Yeah.
You mean the hydro structure?
No, the chemical structure. If there are deflagrations that do not undergo the transition, there should be.
Cosmetic situation with lots of unburned material.
Hmm. they should be well mixed.
And if you did, you should see one season. You should try to think about iron.
Well, it's a question whether you, in a detonation, get intermediates or iron or nickel, depending on the density of the transition.
Yeah, of course.
So it could happen further out when the star has already expanded quite a bit, and then you would just make intermediates in other cases when the detonation
occurs,
you would have the nickel. This would then, of course, determine the chemical structure of the ejection.
This is why this plot's great. It really gets good physics stuff. You know.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, I don't think I'll say any more. I mean, basically, these vary by a factor of two. If you take those parameters and change them so that these are going to increase over a neutron star mass, but that's assuming, you know, they're all changed the same, and that's necessarily true. Let's go to one more slide for this. I mean, here is just the dependence of the explosion parameters from this model. So case one here is the fiducial values I chose, okay? So here's T naught, which is, this is what I get from the fits, and it ranges from about 22 out to about 38 or so, okay? So this is what I get from the fits, this range, T nuts. And so for case one, these are the fiducial values I use, we get nothing at a Chandrasekhar mass. So I can turn the question around and say, okay, say it is a Chandrasekhar mass, and then go ahead and solve for these parameters, kappa, V, and Q. So holding, keeping Q and K constant, we can say the ejected mass is a Chandrasekhar, and we get this velocity, okay? And I've thrown out the two subluminous with that velocity. And that's case two. Okay, so we increase that. We do get near the Chandrasekhar element. And then the same thing, I assume Chandrasekhar mass, we get this. Assume Chandrasekhar mass, we get this. And in all cases, that we really get extreme masses. So
does that mean the mixing if the Q value, whatever you call it, because this will address exactly what Lance is saying. I mean, you would just find it.
Right, I mean, and this is really, I think this is really not believable. I mean, the majority of nickel mixed outside, yeah, right, it's not really plausible. Right, I wrote all that, discussed that in length in the discussion in the paper. So, I mean, so if the model's right or wrong, that's fine. It still just shows the strong dependencies on these values. Okay, let me just summarize those first three segments at the top. And Arnott's rule seems to work astonishingly good, at least with what I've been given, what it exists. We can determine the nickel mass explosion from the peak luminosity. Seems to be a large variation of factor of 10. How can we explain that? I've got one more slide for that. And then we can use luminosity and Arnott's rule to place lower limits on the Hubble constant. And then, again, ejected mass. There seems to be a lot of scatter. What is this implication for the progenitors? Is the model that we use too simple? Perhaps it is. Maybe this is a reason for somebody, for us to work at it harder, try to drive a better model. Maybe using mean opacities just is invalid at this time. And how can we improve? So about that factor of 10 in luminosity, I mean, what's going to cause a factor 10 in luminosity? I don't think we can really explain that. These are obvious choices. You can change the density, the mass. So Wolfgang Schold and Fritz, if you change the density and the metallicity or the carbon-oxygen ratio, if you put them all together, you're only going to change the luminosity by about 20%, not a factor of 10. What Daniel showed us yesterday was that if that really works, it would be another 20%. Still not a factor of 10. We're getting there. We're building up asymmetries, as they showed. Maybe it's a progenitor mass. But how it doesn't seem
well,
so.
Well, you want something that isn't, what Daniel brought in would be statistical. What you want is something that is systematic.
Yeah.
You should not mix those.
Okay, maybe a delayed detonation, but there's physics, yeah. So, I mean, this is, I think, a real problem. Why is there a range of luminosity factor in? I mean, these aren't standard candles. Standardizable, okay. Okay, so this is a little bit new stuff. This is the last segment of the talk. All right, we'll be 45 minutes long. Okay, so now I'm working on, one of the several projects I'm working on is a very, very late time emission. So this is after 300 days from explosion. And this is just a list of the type of physics that you can probe with these type of observations. Peter just now showed about late-time spectra. I'm going to talk about late-time light curves. And also what I just showed earlier with the late-time spectra in Paolo, we can get a measure of the nickel mass. You can use Cecilia's codes and find a measure of the stable elements and their distribution. provides a unique opportunity to probe the magnetic field structure of these beasts. I mean, basically, you can probe it by observing them optically in infrared and produce a bolometric light curve. And then what do we see? This is what we probe. A weak and Rayleigh-Cohn magnetic field will lead to no deposition of positrons. And if the magnetic field is strong and entangled, it will lead to a deposition of positrons. And these we can test by looking at the bolometric light curve at really late times. And so then, therefore, you can then constrain the positron contribution to the galactic 511 KE vine. And then you can study freeze-out effects, and the infrared catastrophe is first suggested by Axelrod in the very early 80s. What was done previously was mostly done by Peter Milnen, and most recently by a student. So here's just a compilation of optical, you know, BVRI late-time light curves. And they all seem to be linearly decaying at 1.4 magnitudes per 100 days. Yeah? Tom, question?
I'm just trying to
decipher
the font.
BVRI, yeah? Yeah, it looks like a mess. Normally I use LaTeX, but. So, and then, and Solomon, and I guess Bob was on the paper, and a number of you showed, you know, really late times. You included some HST stuff. I don't think you can really comment much on just one point, but late times really probing out in optical, it's linearly decaying at 1.4 solar masses, 1.4. Huh? What?
There's a couple of hours out there in
1975.
Okay, this doesn't come out very good, but this just shows you a measure of decline rates. This is from the layer. So, I mean, how do we read this? This is BVRI, and then these are the decline rates for each supernova in those filters. And these solid lines are the mean decline rates from the Milnen work of including over 20 supernova. And basically, what they found here is that the decline rate is around 1.4 magnitudes per 100 days. And then with that, they've then argue that there is no deposition of positrons, okay? And therefore, the magnetic fields are radially weak and radially combed. But they were missing a key ingredient here, and that's in the infrared JHK. So these are the first infrared points, JHK for 2000CX, first observed. That's not true. It's not the first observed, but first well observed. I think 98BU had a couple points, and maybe another one. So what we see here is, I mean, really, there's a flattening in infrared in these bands, okay? And we can go on to 2001EL. This is a paper that's getting refereed right now. I just got a report back. Basically, here's 2001EL. It's quite well sampled at early times. This is from Chris Kunis, Kevin. And then here is all VLT data, so UBVRI. Again, UB and V, UBVR, there's the first late time U-band light curve, but in these, we still see what Milnen saw. It's 1.4 magnitudes per 100 days decline rate. In the eye, it becomes more shallow, around 1. And then we've seen J and H, it just completely levels off. So the emission is basically going from the optical to infrared at these late times. We can show that in this figure. Oh, okay, and this is a bolometric light curve. So I've taken all those points and I've summed them together in the method I described earlier. So here's the early time. And now these points on the upper half, that these show include the GHK, and this is just UBVRI. So basically you can see here at the late times that the emission in the infrared really becomes important, and you can plot that right there and see. So here's a fraction of UVOR energy emitted in GHK. So really late times, it really increases. Okay. And then just two more points, I'll go back to here. What we can do is fit a simple toy model. I didn't draw on the line, but you fit this simple toy model for complete trapping of positrons at late phases from the cobalt decay from like 60 all the way out to the 500 days. And you can get a measure of the nickel mass. And you compare that nickel mass to what we get at peak. And this is always going to be lower because it basically will give you a measure of how much flux we're missing, how much flux is actually read of the K band or in the Z and Y band. Another point, too, is if I were to do a least squares fit to this data, we find the exact decline rate as the positrons, assuming complete trapping. So we really think that this provides evidence for a strong tangled magnetic field. Just let me sum up there. Yes.
Slow, isn't it?
Yes, it's really cool. So basically, it's a temperature effect. So the emission goes from the optical to the infrared. There's 24, 26 micron lines. Okay, and then basically, I don't want to get into physics too much, just really quick. I mean, this increased importance of IR during late times is really, it seems to be a generic feature of all type 1a supernova. And we can just say previous conclusions based just on optical data alone are not correct. Okay, and that, with that, I'm done. So.
From the galaxy for those late time?
Okay, so in the optical, in these, what they did is they went through and did galaxy subtraction, a template subtraction. Now, for 1EL in 2006, the whole point to get a candidate for that observing program is it's got to be away from the galaxy. It's got to be bright, nearby, and away from the galaxy. That's a good question, right? We don't want to observe them if they're right in a star-forming region or something. Bunch?
Yep. Thanks, Mike.